Even if everybody agrees on something politically, there's still a process for making laws and then making regulations to implement those laws. And as you might have noticed, it's not often everybody agrees on anything politically. So lots of people work to help issues and concerns find their way into public policy. And there are people who observe and assist that process, including our next guest. Dr. Mark Lubell is a professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at the University of California, Davis, where he is also the director for the Center for Environmental Policy and Behavior. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Lubell.
Thank you for having me.
What you do looks like pretty fascinating stuff, because while it is about the environment, it's at least as much about how people deal with the environment, it seems.
Yeah, that's correct. I look at environmental decision-making and behavior, especially problems of cooperation in the context of environment, and those are the sorts of issues where it requires a collective effort to solve the problems. I heard, for example, when you were talking about the Salmonid restoration program in a watershed and with your previous guest, and that's one of those sorts of problems when you need to think about how all of the landowners in a particular watershed have to collectively work together to protect salmonid populations.
Yeah, the comment that one landowner can see water flowing past his or her property and then assume that everything is fine downstream was a bit of an eye-opener, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the core issues with these sorts of problems, is that people think about what happens on their private land or their private decision-making, but don't think about how their private decisions impact the other people that are involved with the same problem. So you can think of those as downstream effects, but you see this all the time in human decision-making. Even in example I use with my students is how they manage their common kitchen that they use, and the fact that one person's dishes that pile up also affect the welfare of the other people that are involved. And then I ask them to think about how all the different rules they might come up with to solve or not solve that problem. That's always a lively discussion, because there's always some students who can't solve the problem and their kitchen is a mess forever.
Had you described to the students pretty early on the tragedy of the commons, as Garrett Hardin describes it?
Definitely. That's one of the core things that we talk about, the tragedy of the commons and how to solve it. And one of the interesting things I think about the tragedy of the commons and other sorts of cooperation problems is they're really fundamental to human behavior. Not only are they fundamental in the context of environmental problems, but you just see them all the time in your everyday life, and it's our capacity to solve those sorts of cooperation problems that are really at the heart of human social organization.
Well, and that gets down to the ways that we do organize ourselves, and the fact that we are social creatures. We do want to be around each other, but we're not very good, it seems like, at looking beyond the ends of our own noses.
That is definitely can be the case in why many environmental problems do persist. It's hard to get out of that tragedy of the commons. That is why Garrett Hardin called it a tragedy. It's because the self-interested decision-making of each person leads to the socially undesirable outcome. And just like in a Shakespearean tragedy, where, like in Hamlet, all the actors pursuing their own plots, everybody dies in the end, the tragedy and the tragedy of the commons has a lock-in process from a human decision-making perspective. It's difficult but not impossible to get out of.
Particularly on the environment, do we end up in a lot of either-or scenarios where people think you can have spotted owls, or you can have freckle-faced loggers, as a member of Congress once said, but you can't have both?
Well, yeah. I mean, in some cases, people will see direct trade-offs between, say, old-growth forests and spotted owls, and the environmental problem will have that type of structure to it. But in many different cases, in my opinion, actually, I would say the vast majority of environmental cases, there's ways to find more mutually beneficial outcomes. And that's what you're really trying to aim for in environmental policy. Again, with the example that you had of the Salmonid Restoration Program, what they're trying to do there is find a set of institutional rules or policy rules that enables people to find ways to work together in a mutually beneficial way. If we didn't have that capacity in human society to do that, we'd be in big trouble. If you look at all of the different environmental things that happen in human society and the way we've developed our water systems and all kinds of different things, it's built on a capacity for cooperation. And there's a Nobel Prize-winning political scientist named Eleanor Ostrom, who won her Nobel Prize, describing how different societies get out of that tragedy of the commons by designing rules for self-governance, often at the local level. And it turns out there's a massive diversity of ways that human beings do it, but we are capable of doing it more often than not, in my opinion. There's a few cases that the conflict becomes intractable, say spotted owls versus old growth, if that is one of them. And I think one thing that happens is the media pays attention to the conflict cases and doesn't give enough attention to the cooperation cases where everything's going okay. And so the public has a view that everything is a big fight. And in fact, there's a lot of people like myself who think that cooperation tends to be the norm rather than the exception.
Dr. Mark Lubell is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the director of the Center for Environmental Policy and Behavior at the University of California, Davis, and professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy. You can join the discussion on the Exchange as we talk about how people work together and how policy is shaped in a collective way. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I wish I could disagree with you about the media part on conflict, but having worked in television news for a good bit of my life, I can tell you that, yeah, that is what draws people in. But I can also remember covering situations where people did collaborate and they were often vilified by their own niche group for selling out.
Yeah, that can be a problem. That definitely is a barrier to getting some of the collaborations going. If you you may be familiar with a collaborative effort called the Quincy Library Group, which was one of the original ones in the Sierra Nevada that tried to get collaboration between loggers and environmentalists in Quincy, California.
Yeah, similar situation up here with the Applegate Partnership.
Yeah, the Applegate Partnership is another pretty prominent example. And there's definitely some environmentalists that would say the collaborative path is the wrong way to go, and some logging or economic interests that would argue that the collaborative path is also the wrong way to go and might prefer litigation. And then you have that dissenting voice out there. I think it actually takes, for the collaborative efforts, it actually takes a particular type of individual. This is something that I think is lost on people in theory, but the people who do it every day in practice realize this, that you have to have people in the collaborative processes that are willing to play well with each other. You know, those types of people. You have to be careful about who you invite to the table as far as people who are willing to make those sorts of compromises. The rhetoric on the collaborative processes, like the Applegate Partnership, is we're just going to invite everybody to the table. We're going to make it very inclusive and invite everybody. But the reality is you have to carefully select those people that are willing to find a way to work together.
I could probably talk the theory of this all day. I want to get a little more into the practice, though. I mean, it looks like you use a lot of surveys at the center. Tell us about how the work proceeds.
Well, it depends on what the population is that we're interested in, but usually what we're doing with surveys is we're trying to understand people's attitudes and behaviors and decisions with respect to some sort of environmental issue. And it might be the attitudes of resource users, for example, a farmer who's making a decision on their field or their parcel about what practices to put in place for irrigation or pest management, and what are those practices more or less sustainable. I know up there in the North Coast area, for example, you might be talking about pot growers and marijuana grows where there's issues of sustainability there. That's a legitimate target for survey research. It's hard to reach some of those populations in some cases and get them to respond, but that's the basic idea. We also may survey decision makers more at the policymaker level, so people in agencies or NGOs who are engaged with actually making the policies rather than making the decisions on the ground. And so we identify those populations. We design survey instruments that will actually make sense to those people. And the way we do that is by having a lot of conversations beforehand, call it qualitative research, where we interview people or do focus groups to understand where they're coming from, and then we do a survey, a more quantitative approach, in order to measure their behavior in a more general way.
So you really have to get to know the players with some level of fluency before you even put a survey out there.
Absolutely. You really do have to do it. It's an intensive process to do it right. If you throw out a survey out there that you just, I hear this a lot from people who don't do it. We're just going to do a survey, and we're going to put it up on some online platform like SurveyMonkey, and we're going to survey farmers. And then I say, well, how are you going to reach those people? How are they going to respond? How do you know that the questions that you're asking make sense? If you don't do that groundwork beforehand, not only to know how people are thinking, but also to get your face recognized so that people trust that you're not coming at them for some nefarious or economic purposes, that you're actually out there to try to do some legitimate research that may have practical benefits for them, then you can start to get in the door. So you definitely have to know the context, especially in environmental policy. You need to know the context well before you embark on survey research.
Can you give us an example of a recent issue within the last couple of years where you went through the whole process?
Yeah, sure. Probably the best recent example was I was doing a survey on sustainability and sustainable agriculture in California. And I was surveying the population of what I call outreach professionals, or another way to think about it is the Sustainable Agriculture Knowledge Network. And this was a statewide survey. So the people that I'm going for in this particular survey are the people who provide advice to farmers and do research on sustainable agriculture, develop that knowledge that then is delivered to farmers to make decisions on the ground. So the first thing I had to do is try to figure out who all those people were. And that's not an easy task because there's not a directory out there of outreach professionals. There's many different lists that we had to assemble to try to figure out who the people that were involved statewide in developing and delivering knowledge on sustainable agriculture. To develop that list, we did Google searches. So for every single county in California, we did a Google search that said, sustainable agriculture, Marin County, sustainable agriculture, Mendocino County. And we started collecting the list of organizations that showed up on there and putting those all into a big database. And then we developed a set of questions on the basis of people that are, first we interviewed people about, around sustainable agriculture. I also have done a ton of work in this area before, so I had a good sense of that, what the right questions would be to start out with. And then we made an online web survey, which we delivered to them. We have to deliver it to them multiple times. There's a little bit of a spamming process that has to go in to get people to respond. You can monitor the responses to decide when to stop that. And then we've collected all that data, and now we're in the process of analyzing it. And we ask questions such as, what is their view on sustainability? What sorts of practices do they think support sustainability? Who do they talk to? What are their social networks that they communicate with? Those are typical sorts of questions we would ask in that type of survey.
And then what do you do with the survey results? I mean, you deliver them to somebody, but, I mean, are there situations where people just, these weren't the results we wanted. We're not going to use these?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's definitely situations where there's some results that people might not have expected or agree with, and they might discount them. I found that to be pretty rare. Most of the time, people that I survey are interested in some of the basic results. So we do two types of reporting. We try to, as quickly as possible, do some policy briefs, and you can even find some of these on my center website. You can look up some of these policy briefs where we will take one set of questions on the survey and just provide some basic descriptive statistics about what did people say, what percentage of people agreed or disagreed with different sorts of questions on different sorts of issues. You know, for example, in this recent sustainable agriculture survey, we did a battery of questions on people's use of social media to communicate sustainable agriculture. So we asked them what different sorts of social media tools do they use, Twitter, Facebook, etc. What did they think the advantages and disadvantages of those are? So one of the first policy briefs I'll be writing on that is looking at that set of questions.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, and I would like to hear more when we have more time. Mark Lubell, I hope we can have you back at some point.
Anytime.
Dr. Mark Lubell is a professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at the University of California, Davis, and the director of the Center for Environmental Policy and Behavior. Links on our website, jeffexchange.org.